Major funding for NJ Spotlight News is provided in part by NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com, and by the PSCG Foundation.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, breaking news, remembering Donald Payne Jr. The six-term congressman has died after suffering a cardiac episode, a fierce advocate for lowering prescription drug prices and cancer screening.
He was one of us. He was special. It's going to be difficult to find someone like him.
Plus, President Biden signing a massive $95 billion military aid package to allies in Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan.
It's a huge package, $60 billion. That's a lot of money for a lot of equipment. Some of it sophisticated, some of it more standard. And it comes at a time when Ukraine badly needs it.
Also, the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments on emergency abortion access in states that ban it, with Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill rallying in support of reproductive rights. And the Federal Trade Commission banning employers from enforcing non-compete agreements.
The primary argument is the non-compete agreements restrict ability of workers to move on, perhaps to higher paying jobs, and suppress wages, which hurts the economy overall.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJ PBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us this Wednesday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. We begin with breaking news. New Jersey Congressman Donald Payne Jr. has died. The six-term Democratic representative from Newark suffered from a cardiac episode on April 6th, stemming from complications tied to his diabetes. According to reports, he remained unconscious and in an intensive care unit at Newark Beth Israel Medical Center ever since. Payne became a congressman in 2013 after winning a special election to fill the seat of his late father, Donald Payne Sr., who was the first black congressman in New Jersey history. Payne Jr. previously served as the Newark City Council president and as an Essex County freeholder. During his time in Congress, he pushed to lower prescription drug prices and introduced the Test for Lead Act to protect children from lead-contaminated water. He's also been an advocate of cancer prevention and screening. Payne is survived by his wife and three children. He was 65 years old. Senior political correspondent David Cruz has reaction from local, state, and federal leaders tonight.
A son of the South Ward of Newark, born to a man who became a historic figure in New Jersey, Donald Payne Jr. is being remembered today as a humble public servant who rarely sought the limelight, but who carried the progressive banner from the streets of Newark to the halls of Congress.
He was a very humble, genuine man, loved his children, was very proud of them. And for him to step into the congressional seat and serve out the legacy that his father started was the biggest honor of his life. And he carried that with him every day.
But Essex County Democratic Chairman Leroy Jones, who first met Don Payne Jr. during the Don Payne Sr. campaign for Congress, remembers that Payne Jr. was reluctant to succeed his father when Sr. died in 2012.
A lot of us, at that time, were encouraging him. And it was difficult because he was dealing with grief, for his dad. And, he wasn't looking for the next step. He was very close to his father, that was a big blow to him. And, a lot of folks didn't understand that at the time. He just needed to deal with his own personal healing.
A former toll booth worker and county educational services coordinator, Payne Jr. had risen by then to the presidency of the Newark City Council and the then County Board of Freeholders.
He wasn't one that always looked for the accolades or the press clips or, you know, being in front of a camera.
I'm heartbroken to hear of the passing of my dear friend Donald Payne Jr., said Bonnie Watson Coleman, a fellow member of the delegation today. Like myself, Don came from a family legacy of public service, and we bonded over discussions of our trailblazing fathers. I cherish the 10 years I had the honor of working with Don. Essex County Executive Joe DiVincenzo went to school with Don Payne Sr. and was a longtime friend and political ally of Don Payne Jr. How much were they alike and how much were they different?
No, they were definitely, they're twins. They were twins. The exact same thing, you know, what they stood for. The entire Payne family, though, was it was about the same thing. It was not about money. It had nothing to do with that and not where you live. It was about doing the right thing. And they always told me it was about the principle of the thing. And that's what they did. They did the right thing. And he lived his life to the fullest. You know, he has a great wife, Beatrice. He got three great kids. I feel bad for each one of them, but I know they'll go on and continue your legacy, too.
It was my great honor to work side by side with Donald, said Governor Murphy's statement today. And we will hold his memory close to our hearts as we build upon the Payne family's deep legacy of service. Payne had suffered a cardiac episode recently after years of several health issues.
He handled them, you know, with grace, dignity, you know, and he used them to fight for people that were, you know, that were going through the same health challenges with diabetes and issues that your body is confronted with diabetes.
There is a process for succeeding Payne, who's unopposed in the Democratic primary. Party leaders will choose someone for the fall general election, which today is far away from the minds of the friends of Donald Payne, of which there were many. I'm David Cruz, NJ Spotlight News.
Shipments of weapons and military equipment are en route from the U.S. to Ukraine tonight after President Biden today signed a $95 billion aid package supporting military operations in Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It comes after months of wrangling and debate over how involved the U.S. should be in foreign wars. The bill overwhelmingly passed in the Senate last night with a bipartisan 79-18 vote after the House approved the package on Saturday. In signing the legislation, which includes $61 billion for Ukraine, the president today called it a good day for world peace. Ukraine recently stepped up calls for help from the West as Russia makes significant gains in its invasion. But the approval of the aid is also facing significant backlash in the U.S. because it includes $26 billion to fund Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, which has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians. A Monmouth University poll out today finds public opinion on the package is divided, with just over 40% of Americans in favor and 35% opposed. Also sandwiched in the legislation is a bill that could eventually lead to the banning of TikTok in the U.S., giving Chinese parent company ByteDance roughly 9 months to sell it or be banned from app stores. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky today showing his gratitude for the money and arms help on social media, writing simply, "Thank you, America." But is it too little too late in this war? We turn to Alan Sanders, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at St. Peter's University. Alan Sanders, great to talk to you. I'm curious if this aid package to Ukraine specifically is more of a morale boost, or is this enough money and weapons to shore up Ukraine's defenses and allow it to make some progress this year?
Well, it certainly is a morale boost, but it's also very substantively important. It's a huge package, $60 billion. That's a lot of money for a lot of equipment. Some of it sophisticated, some of it more standard. And it comes at a time when Ukraine badly needs it.
Although we should note the last aid package was somewhere around $75 billion. So it is a bit less. But I guess the question is, how quickly can it get to the front lines, right? And how much good it can do there?
Right. Well, that's a good question. President Biden has said that he will start shipping equipment right away. And so some of it will get there. But of course, other equipment will take longer to get there. But, you know, morale, as we pointed out, is also important. It means that the Ukrainian forces know that reinforcements are coming, and therefore they will be willing to fight aggressively and understand that, you know, they're not alone now anymore.
Predictability of supply has been a big issue for Ukraine, and there is a major offensive Russia is planning for this summer, June or July. It's uncertain at this point. Is this going to put holes in Russia's ability to invade? I mean, what are they up against right now? Just how far behind the eight ball is Ukraine?
Well, they're on the defensive right now. And of course, Russia has huge amounts of equipment and really huge amounts of money that they're willing to commit to this. So they're facing an adversary that is quite powerful and very much so more powerful. But remember, when you're trying to defend territory, when it's your own territory, you have the advantage of knowing the ground and also having support of the local population. So Ukraine faces immense odds, but nonetheless, this will be a huge boost. And we know, as you pointed out, that the summer months are the months when the conflict really blows up even further because the weather permits that. And so this aid comes at a key moment when the weather is now turning in a way that will allow for battlefield combat to progress. And so it's important for Ukraine to have all the equipment it needs at this point.
I'm thinking about the presidential election in November, and if President Trump is reelected, what that will mean for Ukraine, and consequently, if Europe will step up to help Ukraine fill in some of its shortfalls.
Well, Europe is committed to the defense of Ukraine, and it will step up. But the reality is that the Europeans are much more disorganized, and they talk a lot, and they do a lot less than what they talk about. That's part of the problem of the European Union and the European states individually. If Trump gets reelected, yes, this will mean real trouble for Ukraine because Trump now heads an isolationist wing of the Republican Party.
Let me ask you quickly about the Israel portion of this, because in making his remarks today, President Biden said that there are, war atrocities, violations of international law being committed by Russia, and pointing out that that's why it's important to get this funding over to Ukraine. But is that not the same argument being made by members of Congress like Bonnie Watson Coleman, members of the Senate, who voted against the package strictly because it contains money for Israel, who is accused of doing the same?
Well, it's accused of doing the same, but whether it is actually doing the same is really up for debate. Look, the Israelis are facing a war of national security. The enemies, Hamas and Iran, and all the other enemies that surround Israel, have said that they want to wipe Israel off the map. And so when you're facing adversaries of that type, you're going to take some very aggressive countermeasures and military measures. Now, whether some of those have exceeded, conventional standards, we'll have to wait and see.
Professor Alan Sanders for us tonight. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Brianna. Take care.
The United States Supreme Court today took up a key case in the national abortion debate on whether Idaho's near-total abortion ban conflicts with a federal law protecting patients in medical emergencies. The decision could affect other states that have put abortion bans in place. And while New Jersey isn't one of them, Democratic Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill has signed on to a friend of the court brief with other congressional Democrats imploring the court to uphold the law. Raven Santana reports.
Pro-life is a lie. They don't care if people die.
Hundreds of abortion rights and anti-abortion protesters flooded the entrance to the U.S. Supreme Court as the justices heard arguments regarding emergency abortion access. The court is weighing whether Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act should cover emergency abortions, even in states where the procedure is banned. And the test case comes from Idaho, where the state enacted a law which allows a woman to get an abortion only when her life, not her health, is at risk.
What if you need an abortion, not because you're going to die, but because you will lose your uterus and therefore no longer be able to have children? That's a reason under EMTALA where a physician could say, okay, we need to go ahead and do an abortion. Under Idaho law, you could not do that.
Kimberly Mutcherson is a professor of law at Rutgers Law School. Mutcherson says this really boils down to one question. Could a state actually say we will require women in our state to die if they are pregnant and they need an abortion?
This question of exactly how far states can go is a really significant question. And it's one, frankly, that is not going to just be sorted out on the state level. It's going to end up in the Supreme Court.
The hearing is the latest legal challenge that could impact abortion access across the country. Here in New Jersey, advocates and lawmakers, including Congresswoman Mikey Sherrill, who is a leading advocate for reproductive freedom, are urging the court to uphold the law.
The reproductive health care in states that are imposing these draconian laws is getting worse and worse and worse, because you have a combination of doctors being afraid to provide basic treatment because of these laws that involve criminal time if the state disagrees with the decision the doctor made.
The Congresswoman made her remarks alongside doctors and staff at the Cooperman Barnabas Medical Center, where she also gave birth to her daughter. She says laws like Idaho's are not only putting a heavy burden on women, but they also lead to doctors leaving the state, making outcomes even worse for women living there.
You also then see doctors in those states saying, look, I have a Hippocratic oath, and so I am not going to practice in a hospital like the one we spoke about today, where a woman has a miscarriage in the bathroom of the lobby because they won't process her in.
We are not just talking about elective termination of pregnancy. We are talking about women who have failed pregnancies, women who have babies that will be non-viable or non-living if they are carried to term, pregnancies that endanger the lives of women, where they will have life-threatening bleeding and complications.
Dr. Kimberly Powar is an attending physician in the emergency department of the hospital and sees firsthand how this emergency care can be the difference between life and death for many moms.
And that they don't need to wait until they are so critical that it's difficult to take care of them.
Mutcherson believes the vote could come down to a split decision where it ends up being all women on one side. She urges viewers to pay attention to the bigger picture.
So I hope that as people are watching these cases go through the Supreme Court, that they aren't just thinking about whether they believe in abortion or don't believe in abortion, but they're also thinking about who gets to decide what rights any of us has in a whole host of different circumstances.
For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Raven Santana.
There are new details tonight on the Murphy administration's plans to split up the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and create two separate state agencies. As first reported by Politico, the administration agreed to a $4 million contract with the consultant McKinsey & Co. to help guide the overhaul. As senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan reports, the shakeup comes after a bungled pandemic response at state-run veterans' homes that caused hundreds of residents to die.
I'm cautiously optimistic.
It's Jay Boxwell's mission to protect New Jersey veterans, especially those living in state-run veterans' homes where hundreds died of COVID. So after multiple reports and lawsuits identified glaring errors and mismanagement at the Menlo Park and Paramus facilities run by Jersey's Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, or DMAVA, Boxwell's glad the state hired McKinsey consultants to help restructure the whole system.
We hope that this is going to be truly an unbiased look of the operation systems in DMAVA. There's a lot of programming that they've never been able to justify how those funds are being spent or where the money's going.
The $4 million contract with McKinsey will map out splitting DMAVA into two separate cabinet-level state agencies, Military Affairs and Veteran Services. It outlines three phases. One will analyze DMAVA's current operating structure and identify best practices and budgets. Phase two will create operating plans for two new agencies. And phase three will design an orderly transition that identifies costs. With so many tangled revenue streams, that's important, says Senator Joe Cryan.
One of the things that the report will give us that will aid in that is the color of money, federal money versus state money, how we maximize those federal dollars, how we make sure we don't lose them.
Cryan's working with other lawmakers, including Senator Joe Vitale, to draft the complex legislation required to break DeMava apart. It'd address items like war memorials, cemeteries, veteran services such as transportation, place vets' offices in almost every county, and crucially, create an independent veterans advocate who'll listen to complaints.
There's the lack of transparency, and that's what the residents and staff were afraid of, and the retaliation, you know, the poor culture of the managers, again, you know, us against them mentality, instead of working for a collaborative effort to serve those veterans.
So we continue to try to make sure that we get input that matters. And I think ultimately, Brenda, that's what matters. Just get it right. You've made the mistakes. Get it right.
Meanwhile, DeMava is also seeking millions to renovate and expand its vulnerable nursing homes by building private rooms and isolation wings, implementing hard lessons learned from both the pandemic and a scathing lawsuit filed by the U.S. Department of Justice. DeMava's commanding officer told Senate Budget Committee members,
"This is part of our efforts to be among the best equipped long-term care facilities in New Jersey. We are investing more than we ever have to support service members, veterans, and their families."
That will require both state and federal funding. The McKinsey report's due in June, and lawmakers hope to unveil legislation not long afterwards. I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
In our Spotlight on Business report tonight, the Federal Trade Commission just made it easier to leave your job. Regulators on Tuesday enacted a nationwide ban on new non-compete agreements for nearly all workers, making it illegal for bosses to try to force employees into signing non-competes in any scenario and voiding most existing non-compete contracts. It'll affect an estimated 30 million workers in the U.S., according to the FTC. Non-competes bar workers from jumping to or starting a competing company for a certain period of time. The new rules will take effect later this year unless a lawsuit filed today by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a national tax firm block it from moving forward. So what should workers expect? I'm joined by Rutgers labor and employment law expert James Cooney. James Cooney, thanks so much for joining the show. A lot to unpack here. So let me ask you first, what were the arguments made about why non-competes hurt workers and, by extension, the economy?
Certainly, and it's a pleasure to be here. The primary argument is that non-compete agreements restrict ability of workers to move on, perhaps to higher paying jobs, and suppress wages, which hurts the economy overall.
So do we have any indication about how much money, I'm talking about the stifling of wages, could potentially be put back into the economy? I think a lot of us picture senior level executives, but non-competes run the gamut, don't they?
They sure do. I've seen workers at all different levels impacted by them. The Federal Trade Commission estimates that this rule, once it goes into effect, will result in over $400 billion being pumped into the economy over a decade. So they really take the position that this is going to help improve the economy overall.
What are the implications, though, for businesses? Because the practice has been, listen, this is how we keep our trade secrets ours. This is how we keep client and customer lists within house. What's to stop workers from then either starting their own business or sharing that information when they jump to a competitor?
Yeah, you know, businesses have a legitimate concern on that point, but there's things that already are being done by businesses to take care of those issues. For example, they can have workers enter into non-disclosure agreements or confidentiality agreements, which will protect trade secrets and intellectual property, but, you know, will not be the, you know, the heavy hammer preventing a worker from moving on to a new job.
So if I'm an employee currently bound by a non-compete, what happens now? Is that null and void?
Well, it will be in around 6 months. That's when this rule will go into effect. And at that point, employers are going to be required to tell workers that they will not enforce any non-compete agreement that has been entered into, with an exception for senior executives, people making over $151,000 involved in policy making. But for all other workers, it will render those agreements essentially null and void.
Very quickly, there are lawsuits filed today, U.S. Chamber of Commerce being one of the filers there. Do you anticipate those suits having legs? I mean, is there a potential here that the FTC overstepped its authority?
I think there actually is a fair likelihood that a judge might find this to be an excess of authority. That's going to be the argument for sure that the Chamber of Commerce is going to make, essentially saying this agency did not have the authority to do this by way of rules, but this is something that Congress would have needed to do by legislation. So I think it is a real possibility this rule could be caught up in the court system for quite a while.
James Cooney is an attorney, a professor at the Rutgers School of Management and Labor Relations. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Turning to Wall Street, stocks slipped today over more interest rate fears. Here's how the markets closed.
Support for the Business Report is provided by Junior Achievement of New Jersey, providing students with skills and knowledge to explore, choose, and advance their career paths for a bright future. Online at janj.org.
And that does it for us tonight, but make sure you tune in to a special edition of Chatbox tomorrow night with David Cruz. He moderates a conversation with all three Democratic U.S. Senate candidates vying to replace the embattled senior senator Bob Menendez. That's Thursday at 6 p.m. on the NJ Spotlight News YouTube channel, and then this weekend, Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 10 a.m. right here on NJPBS. I'm Brianna Venosi for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
New Jersey Education Association, making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.